as an issue because I get charged with it all the time. I know when it came up once in my seminar, one young woman, I think of her always as an equestrian. She liked philosophy, but she loved horses. And when that came up, she sighed and she said, that question, she said, there are only two areas in which we legitimate elitism in our society, and this is sports and money. You know? There we take it for granted that that there are distinctions and we honor those distinctions, but anywhere else, no.
Then the question arises is, how do the elect become the elect? Well, or elite. But it, actually the word in this text was elect, but elite. So how does that condition arise?
I think a farmer would say cream just naturally rises to the top. Pretty hard to stop it unless you homogenize it.
It's not
not an admissible notion to for somebody to think of himself as above the other.
But also, then the notion of Zen, if nothing special, nobody special.
That's right.
It's very contrary.
That's right.
To essential Buddhism.
Well, but again, is it? It seems to me that you've announced the countervailing word that one must always balance it with. But even in Buddhism, there is the Buddha's statement, when he achieved enlightenment, there is in all heaven and earth, there is none like and unto me. That's not his words. Those are Christian words. But I am the soul or something like that. So I think you get it in Zen too, but again, once you get the elite and the non-elite, well, then you've got a dualism, so you know that you've got to come in and in some way undercut that, but not annihilating the previous point, or you're back into, what should we say, only non-dualism. And that's an exclusive position too. Let me come at it this way. It's not very nice to say I'm the elite and the other, and that's the way people always move in on that notion. But it's possible to approach that from a different way. Namely, I know that there are people who are older souls than I am. And unless I allow for some kind of elitism or hierarchy, there is no way that I can say that. And that counsels a kind of complacency. Do you agree?
Even in the Zen tradition, you have the Zen master and the student. That's a hierarchy right there. Mm-hmm. Just because you have a master and a teacher.
Mm-hmm. It seems also that the master attains that position by virtue of a master having recognized his student and giving Dharma transition.
Yeah, but don't you see my point?
Sure, I see the point.
Yeah, you may have worked for it, but the point is they have the two different levels.
Yeah.
So because you were the one who brought up the point about equal in Buddhism in that era. And as soon as you have a teacher and you have a student, especially in the Zen master tradition, there's a very great separation between the two. One is definitely above the other.
And getting there involves steps, actually. Mm-hmm. I mean, in the tradition with which I'm familiar. one goes through certain initiatic experiences in terms of the attainment of that situation on the inner and the outer level. But, you know, this whole, I mean, it's like, you know, money and power and everything, it's a kind of interesting button for our culture, you know, our democratic culture. Because it's like, for example, when the first time I heard this expression used was by this Rinpoche's wife, the one who's coming today, and something bad was happening to somebody else, and she said to this somebody else with this look of utter joy and compassion, she said, "But how wonderful, your karma is ripening." And all of a sudden I went, whoa, that's an interesting way to look at suffering. It's the great opportunity to have your karma ripen. And your karma can ripen through the path of suffering, or it can ripen through this path of attainment. And they can be the same path. In other words, the suffering can be the vehicle for your attainment in some situations, or you know, you can attain in some instances without touching into the field of suffering at all. So it's like, how wonderful, your karma is ripening. That you have attained gnosis. That you have apprehended the mysterium. You know, it's like, but what concerns me, and I think it's probably you know, a concern in the mind of those who dance with Krishnamurti, is the clubs that are created by the half-attained knowers.
Right. And that is so, creates so much damage that we cannot be reminded too much of that. I mean, we need always to keep that in mind. I think my, speaking for myself at the moment, my ballast is on the other side. I hear that element pressed so hard that, and I agree with it, the element of look at the damage that it's done, that that the countervailing point is not recognized at all. Because it's done this damage, let's throw out the notion. And that, to me, is, well, baby with the bathwater kind of thing.
Again, this place has, you know, so many masters and so many apprentices and shamans and, you know, elitists and non-elitists. This is a great place to watch the dance of spiritual bizarreness. And, you know, we sure have had a real wonderful look at spiritual pitfalls. And one of the most damaging attitudes among those who are actively on the path is what is called in the Christian tradition contemptus mundi, contempt of the world, contempt of your brothers and sisters who you regard as, you know, poor nitwits who don't know anything. And I remember years ago when Stan and I were together, since he was one who, you know, taught me the term, and then I recognized that, you know, it was something that we were also living. You know, we had a certain contempt for people who, you know, didn't know, so to speak. That it became a real issue in my life to deal with the spiritual arrogance that comes about when you have only a little bit of knowledge.
That's right. That's right.
Peak. P-E-E-K. Experience, not P-E-A-K.
That's good. That's good.
Yeah. And so, you know, I mean, and Stan actually, even though we were entrapped by contemptus mundi in our own situation, his explanation of it I thought was just fantastic, because it's a, literally, he explained it as a projection of the ego, the unfinished business with the ego to, you know, entities in the external world, you know, institutions or individuals.
Right.
Where, you know, you don't own the unfinished business within yourself, but you lay it out there, and then you have contempt for it. As soon as you obtain forgiveness of your own limitations, which is one of the things that we dance with here, I mean, it's like I said, Now I'm aware of my limitations.
Right.
So it's okay. I feel really easier every year
sure.
with the situation of the confinement and the lack of confinement, which is also a limitation. But that sense of forgiveness, to me, becomes the first step in the development of compassion.
Right.
And it's forgiveness of one's own situation, you know, the damage you've done to yourself and others. And very often, that is the exact trap where people get stuck forever.
Right.
In this arrogant position, which is why some of us were spinning off, you know, Krishnamurti's arrogance in the relation with you. I mean, you were there in almost a childlike way, Houston. You know, but Krishnamurti's arrogance is what pushed my button because of, you know, that sense of I've got it and you don't. And the lack of recognition that, you know, we all have it, though we might not all know that we, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So that's just one of the great dangers.
Well, if we put aside the Krishnamurti example as being, what, arrogant or authoritative, this came out last night, and two ways of reading that. But if we, because there are two ways, if we just put that aside, but on the point, yes, the you know, spiritual pride is the last trap. And what a trap it is. What a trap. But I think one of the interesting things about this manner of elitism is that those who really are further along, an evidence of it is that this notion of elitism dissolves and vanishes. That's right. And so they come out saying, "There, but for the grace of God, go I," and seeing someone taken off to be hanged. But also the Zen phrase, "Nothing special," you know. And they really, really live that. They're in a condition where, you know, to us it looks extraordinary, astonishing, and yet from their standpoint, there's nothing special. I imagine this a little bit like, what should we say? Stars, famous people. To us from the outside, why, maybe that seems like a special condition. But if you got there, I don't know that it would feel, life would feel that different. I don't know if that analogy, maybe we ought to...
You know, in a way it does and in a way it doesn't, but it's like that wonderful Bruegel painting where the Pope and the King are, you know, dead or die, right? And they're, you know, the skeletons holding the bodies of these two eminent types. And so are all the poor people. And, you know, as Billy Graham once said, "I never saw a hearse with a U-Haul behind it." I mean, you know, the event of death is a great equalizer.
Yeah.
And there you are. So what?
Yeah.
And the only thing that can modify your experience of death is not your bank account, nor your pseudo-spiritual attainments, but you know, really having done your work in a correct manner.
Yeah.
And I, you know, it's my belief that that's not so easy. Because
yeah.
I think that not only are we deluded about what the correct manner is, but that the conditions of our culture also play into our self-delusions. And that is a real, you know, it's like Martha saying, well, creating a kind of macro sacred goulash or a theosophical impulse to bring it all into one. I mean, it's a point of great difficulty because the choices, the individual choices are so enormous that it's like you're at a Chinese banquet and if you eat everything on the table, you're going to die of indigestion.
Mm-hmm.
So this skillful means and discriminating wisdom that the Buddhists talk about, and the mystery being in the locus, the place of the individual, that is the indication from the Gnostic point of view is so totally appropriate
mm-hmm.
for this particular time.
Mm-hmm. Yes, Leon.
Two things in my mind. One, many are called, the few are chosen.
Few are chosen.
And then the idea in Judaism from which Jesus was brought up, of the idea of the chosen people.
Right. Well, I think we ought to, that's a very intriguing concept, and I think we ought to look with positive terms on that. At least I like to. I mean, it can, like everything, these are, the more one gets into the depth domain of these concepts, the subtler it gets, the point where a slight mismove will just make the whole thing go sour. Like who was quoting the on Believing in Mind, Sen's song, a hair's breadth difference in heaven and hell is set apart. And the notion of the chosen people, I think, well, I like to just turn that over and think about that in positive terms. That doesn't exclude other civilizations and peoples from having their own specialness. But I think specialness has positive kind of, again, the abuses that can go with it, sure. Do you disagree?
Well, you know, being hyper indoctrinated into Zen, and what you said to me is really important, is that when you've attained whatever, enlightenment, liberation, or whatsoever, then you become one with everything, therefore nothing special.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like there are all sorts of wonderful stories about Zen masters who have, you know, gone off into the life of total anonymity, and they're fairy men and they're whatsoever's, but you know, they are sweeping the streets like idiots, and they're totally unrecognized by most people, and they live the humble life, so to speak. So it's, you know, there's an inner experience, and that inner experience in the final thing is the attainment of oneness with everything, which includes the beggar.
All right.
The,
but can the nothing special be seen with the other side of it as everything special?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
But now note, the second gives a kind of point to particularity and finite differences. Everything special.
Okay.
So I think that's the way that chosenness as specialness doesn't mean that we're not all special in other way. That's the way I like to look at it. But Myron, your answer.
Well, I don't really know that I have too much to say, so I'll just start all
right.
A bit and see what happens. I think that I first must acknowledge that there is a number of elite, some way or another.
Right.
There are obviously people that are way up there
sure.
in comparison to the likes of us.
Sure.
But it's come to my attention that these people have two things in common. One is they don't think out. And two, they speak clearly, they speak softly, and they seldom argue the point. In other words, if there's a bunch of static, they are not going to pound the table and say, oh, no, it's all wrong, the moon is really made of green cheese, you're mistaken, and on and on. In other words, they'll make their point and back off. And in other words, they speak softly, but they're still in there doing something, whatever it is their field is. even into old age. Mm-hmm. This is, I would say, a touchstone that I found useful insofar as I think I've been able to separate two different kinds of creatures that sometimes consider themselves to be elite, and frequently I think that it's correct that a modest person doesn't say something much about this. Most of them don't, that I've run into, and there's only been a very few that I've met that I really feel belong to this class, but they're all soft-spoken, and they also have a sense of humor.
That's
another thing.
But would you say that those who say they are elite aren't necessarily the
I would
elite?
Surely say that.
Okay, that's what I was going to ask you, Myron. Who chooses the elite?
I don't think it's a matter of choosing. I think that that is a mistaken idea in the process of this particular conversation of what constitutes an elite. I don't know that we can define it. I think we all know it when we see it, in the same way that we see cream come to the top.
Mm-hmm. Okay, yeah. If I am a lamp unto myself, those are elite who I recognize as elite.
All right. I think that introduced a useful point. I guess where I am, I think it's very important that we keep the notion of elite in our vocabulary and in our worldview, balanced also by the countering notion that demolishes all distinctions and all dualities. Both of those. But another thing is, let's keeping elite, but have richness in the dimensions of elitism. That is, some people are elite, some people are very smart, some people do math, or whiz kids with math and so on. Others are marvelous with their bodies and dance. Jim, an elite cook, if I have ever run into one from my brief samplings, as well as a human being and so on. So let's just have many of those criteria, but none of this premature leveling. Mm. There is a sublime leveling, but to roll that in too quickly is to demolish all standards prematurely, I think. Well,
talk a little bit about Thomas Merton in your closing.
2 minutes left. 2 minutes for Thomas Merton. Pardon?
Any new book?
No time for the new book. Thomas Merton is something else, though. I accepted an invitation to a week's conference in Calcutta. It turned out to be the month before he died, because Thomas Merton was going to be there, and I spent as much of that week as I could with him. And the first time we were alone together, it was after a session, we were having a cool drink in Calcutta, coconut juice or whatever. And when I had a chance, to just move in on him, the way I did it, I said, I have a monkish aspect to my nature, but it is not the dominant aspect. And so that is a life I shall not know, at least not in this reincarnation. And what I would like to hear from you is, what is that life like? And he said, his immediate response was, well, it's very nice. And that kind of surprised me right off, because I thought that, I thought of that life as having a lot of difficulty. For one thing, you do not have full access to the other half of existence, the feminine and so on. And mortifications, Trappist silence, and so on. I thought maybe difficulty would prompt, but it wasn't that. It's very nice. So I asked him to say, well, I forget whether this came immediately, but I asked him about his way of life. He said, you mean how does a typical day go? And he says, yeah. And I said, yeah. Well, he said, I get up at 4 o'clock in the morning, and I do my matins prayers. He's a hermit, but within a stone's throw of the Gethsemane. And then, having completed that, I turn to breakfast, and I put on a pot of coffee. And he said, "That's marvelous." He said, "That carries me through the morning." And then I scramble, I scramble some eggs, singing in tongues all the while. You know, that phrase I thought was wonderful. And then when breakfast is over, I turn to writing. And so that's a golden part of the day for me. And then he went on lunch and so on. Afternoon, about 3 hours working around in the shrubbery, cleaning up the land and things like that, physical activity in the afternoon. And then in the evening, he had a secretary to help him with the correspondence and things like that. Anyway, that was wonderful. And then when we left the conference, we went on to, we flew to Delhi, where he was going to Bangkok, you know, and I was coming back to the States. And we had this marvelous time. No, I was going up to see the Dalai Lama before I came home. And he said, "Well, I'm tempted to just run up there with you before I go to Bangkok." And then our fantasies just ran away with us. We said, "Let's walk to Ladakh or whatever, do a trek." And he said, "I'll cancel my Bangkok." And I said, "I'll wire my dean and my wife saying, forget about us. I don't know where it's going from here." And it's just that kind of exuberant, manic, "Let's just do it, never mind the consequences." But I guess we both knew that we wouldn't. We were just doing a simulation that would never happen. So we got to the Delhi airport and took our separate flights. And within 3 weeks, there was the word from Bangkok of his accident with the electrical apparatus. And I'm glad you asked for that. There's nothing I would rather have ended with in Gnostic Christianity, where he was for sure a real one, than this actual embodiment. Thank you very much. Gassho. Gratitude and respect for the company of fellow seekers. A marvelous place.